This is Dennis Wilkins, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 3rd of May 2012. Dennis Wilkins, Part 1.
Dennis Wilkins, and my place of birth was Newcastle upon Tyne, UK, 28/4/42. So I was a war baby.
So you're now on the verge of being 70?
I am 70. You are 70 on Saturday. Last.
It's nice to be interviewing somebody so young on this project. What were your parents? What was your father's profession?
Dad was a clerk in the electricity board in Cambridge, and my mum, I won't denigrate my dad, but my mum's family is very interesting because they were Irish stock who actually were displaced during the Troubles, her family, and came over to Durham to work as miners. You know, they came over as miners or navvies, didn't they, when they were cleared out of Ireland. And so they were all miners. And I remember happy days, really, up in Newcastle for the first few years with all my uncles ingrained black coal dust in their faces and coming home absolutely black all over and pulling out the old tin bath in front of the fire. And just, you know, didn't matter who was there, whether it was the neighbour's wife or whatever, just stripping off and getting on with bathing, and then a big plate of food and off down the bub, gander down the bub. So yeah, so it was an interesting family. They're all miners, all died pretty well, gasping their last over the fireplace from black lung, as they used to call it, which was miners' silicosis.
You don't have the requisite accent.
Are we a man?
For Geordie.
No, of course not. I was only brought up there for the first year or two during the war, and then we came back down to Cambridge, which is where my father's place was. Very old Cambridge family. I think the first recorded presence was in the round church there, the wedding register of 1750. And there was an Ingram, which was the forebears, getting married there. So that's part of the country. It's interesting, isn't it, the Bass has ended up there now. And so it's come full circle.
What sort of education did you have then?
Grammar school boy.
Soham
Grammar School. 11 plus, yes. Soham Grammar. And it was actually the school where those poor girls were murdered. But, of course, it stopped being a grammar school as a result of the Crossland Vendetta in 1972. And the Warnock Report and all that, and all those schools became community colleges or comprehensives. But to still go back to the old boys' reunions, still a nice old school.
And further education?
Went to Liverpool, medical school there, terrific place. And got my medical qualification there. And then I stayed on and did my primary surgical examinations to get a foot on the ladder and just see that I was marked out as being serious about a career in surgery before taking this sort of career break to go to the Antarctic. And then I did a degree, a doctorate, based on work I did in the Antarctic, did my MD.
Was medicine anywhere in the family, history?
No.
So what was the draw?
Just a bit of adventure. I mean, 6 or 8 years of medicine in Liverpool and the rest of it, and I always liked open places, done a bit of climbing, not much, this, that and the other. It was just a break and something exciting to do and different.
What was the draw to medicine, though, in the first place?
In medicine? Medicine. Well, it's funny, isn't it, how life turns on little moments. And there was one Friday afternoon when the master, Mr. Webb, was going round, I think, trying to fill in the last few minutes of the period, asking the lads, the boys, what they wanted to do. And I'd been reading The Practical Home Doctor and showing off to my mates that I knew all the names of the bones in the body. What are you going to do, Wilkins? And I said, oh, I'm going to be a doctor, sir. Yes, really? And since I was in the stream, which was doing technical stuff and woodwork and all that sort of thing, he sort of reflected on that. Anyway, on Monday, bless him, and this is how good the school was, on Monday he came up to me and said, Wilkins, he said, are you serious about wanting to be a doctor? Oh, yes, sir. Of course. And He said, well, go and get your books, and you're moving over to the Latin stream, OK? And that was it. You were fixed. You couldn't go back, even if you changed your mind. So, great man, Mr. Webb. Terrific master.
You never regretted that incident?
No, no, no. I mean, come on, medicine gives you a key to so many different directions.
Yes.
And I've got a daughter now who's a medic, and three other daughters, you know, two of whom are physiotherapists. So, yeah, medicine's a great kirk. Great kirk.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic? When did you first begin to realise there was a place down there called that?
Well, I have to say I'm pretty ignorant about it, like most people. Penguins, Arctic or Antarctic and all that sort of stuff. But I read an article in the Sunday Times when I was either first year doing my medical house jobs, or maybe as a final year student, I can't remember. And that article was about the British Antarctic Survey, and that made me think, gosh, and they'd got bases down there, and they took chaps to go down there, and I thought, fantastic. And then I'm a bit of a goal-driven person, have to see something at the end of it. So when I decided I wanted to do surgery, the first exams are pretty tough. You have to know a huge amount of anatomy, physiology, pathology, and that weeds out people really who I guess haven't got the stamina or the commitment to do it. So I promised myself that if I got a place with the British Antarctic Survey, I would get that sorted before I went. And it worked. I kept my nose to the grindstone, eschewed the women, well, not all, and the drink, and the strong drink, and other distractions, and got on with working, and passed it. Took the exam in Dublin, because they're interchangeable, and by that time I was into the application and all the rest of it, and, you know, it all came together.
Well, had you read about Scott and Shackleton? Had you seen the famous film?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, I'd read all those. And once I'd sort of had the spark, you start taking an interest, don't you? Mm. And so you started reading up about these heroes and the rest of it, and you realise what terrific chaps and achievements they had and all that sort of stuff.
Did you know or meet any FIDs before that point?
Liverpool had one FID who I actually sought out when I was thinking of going down there. And he was a chap called Henry Wyatt. And he was a lovely guy. Now, I forget which base he'd been on, but he was something of a, not a legend, but he was known around the place. And he became an eye surgeon. And I think he went off to Canada eventually. But I sought him out. And talking to him, it was pretty inspirational. And sort of reaffirmed what a great place it was and bolstered the determination to go. So, yes, he's the only FID I met in the sort of gestation period.
But interestingly, you were at college with a handful of potential FIDs, weren't you? There were others who were thinking the same way as you.
Yeah, well, whether they were... I mustn't sort of overplay my part in it, but whether... I mean, I talked a lot about it, as you do, and I just sort of had the feeling that it was, you know, I sparked that interest up. I may be wrong, and Terry Allen and luminaries like that would probably say, oh, no, I... But I think...
He does blame you.
Yeah, he blames me. Yes, good. OK. And Mike Holmes, who was another guy as well, who I was in this dreadful house called Number 6 with, one of the few places where you could actually take the engine of your car to bed with you. Magic. So it got talked around, and I think it's probably stimulated that. These guys. And there was David Hughes as well, who's an anaesthetist.
Was there another chap called Steve Valance?
Steve, now I lost track of Steve. I don't know what happened to him. What happened to him?
I don't know.
No. But I have to say that rings a bell, but I can't really sort of picture him, you know.
Okay. Tell me about Mike Holmes, because of course he frequently appears in his interviews as being the doctor who via radio oversaw the Ken Portwine saga.
Yeah.
What sort of chap was he? Well, he is. He's still alive. He's in Australasia somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah, so I lost track of him. Mike was a dear friend. He, one of the great world's great eccentrics, you know. And you know, how can you put it? Very, very clever and lateral thinker in many ways, but other times, you know, quite infuriating, and he knew that as well. But dull, never. Dull, never. And he was madly in love with a Chinese lady, a student, and they went out for a long time together. And Mike, so we kept in touch all the way through. I knew him pretty well beforehand. Then he went down there, and he was down there a bit before I was. And at some point, and I'm a bit hazy on this, he, generous chap that he was, said, "You can share my my bedsit." Now, he lived in a one-room bedsit in Hampstead, pretty salubrious part of Hampstead, and not a lot of space, big house with lots of these bedsits where people just come and go. And I dossed down there pretty well free of charge for several months, and we had some good sessions together. But I've never forgotten that act of generosity when I was really, you know, at a low ebb in terms of dosh and all the rest of it. So he's a good chap, Mike. Good chap, and I've rather lost touch with him.
Good. So you applied to Bass, and I imagine therefore you were then summoned for an interview. Do you remember much about that day?
Yes, I remember it was in Gillingham Street, as many of us were summoned, Victoria. One found one's way to this place and up a few flights of stairs, and in you went. And I just remember it being like a bit like my study is at the moment, just piles of books and papers, and you just sat down in an office and had a chat. It didn't seem to be any sort of formal interview. But I seem to remember Morris was there as well as Bill Sloman.
Morris.
You've got me.
Doesn't matter. Don't worry, we can look it up.
It'll come, if I don't think of it. 70 years old, you see.
Mm.
But they were the two who made the decisions. And they were very wise heads. They made very few mistakes. Maybe this was a mistake. But they seemed to make very few mistakes with the people they sent down there. Pretty good judges of characters, I think.
Well, I was going to ask you whether they were asking you questions about your medical knowledge or just simply psyching you out.
Well, it was just a chat, and I can't remember much about it. You know, I don't have much memory of it, except it was just very friendly and the rest of it and so forth. And at the end of the chat, they said, "Yeah, well, that's fine. You know, we'll take you on and all the rest of it." And I think I made plain at that time that I really would prefer not to go down and sit on the base, because I could see that would be a problem. You'd end up going down and just, you know, doing not quite an office job, but, you know, that sort of work in a very nice setting. And I wanted to make sure that I actually did some travelling with sledging in there.
So did you negotiate which base you would go to at that point?
Nope, they told me.
They told you?
They told me, yeah.
Did you know where it was?
No. a vague notion, but no, I didn't, I'd be honest.
It's an interesting decision to make, isn't it? Because being a doctor is a bit of a conveyor belt career. If you step off the conveyor belt, you can kind of stall your career.
Mm.
Was that a concern, or did you believe that actually doing something odd with your life was actually better for you than the conveyor belt?
Well, that's what I gambled. But I looked at the chaps around me. I looked at the senior registrars who I worked with and respected greatly. And these are the people who did all the work. You know, they were hugely experienced and the rest of it. And they looked after the juniors. And they were pasty-faced. They'd got a mortgage, a family, and they'd had a straight-through career. Some of them, most of them, in fact. And I thought, you know, to end up like that without actually having had a bit of adventure seems to me a bit of a shame.
Mm.
So that sort of spurred me to do it and take a chance. And I thought it was a reasonable chance that if you did something different, it wouldn't go against you. And, you know, basically I thought, well, I don't care. You know, I want to do surgery, but if it doesn't work out and this doesn't help me, well, too bad.
But it seems that perceived wisdom in the medical profession was the opposite, because hardly anybody applied at that point.
Yeah, Yeah.
I mean, they weren't exactly overwhelmed with the candidates, were they?
No, that's, I think, because, I mean, imagine, here was a chap who really hadn't got anything to commend him. I mean, I wasn't a great climber or any huge Antarctic experience or anything like that. Just a medic, for heaven's sake. And I also was wanting to go off base as not a precondition, but made it pretty clear that that's what I wanted to do, which is not a very, what's the word thing? It's not a very wise thing for the only doctor to do on an isolated base where there's no other help or whatever. And indeed, when John Brotherhood had his accident, that point was underlined. So, yeah, I think they were very good to take us on. And as you say, there weren't many applicants in those days. Of course, it's completely different now.
Mm. Did you have to have a medical?
Yes. I'll tell you about that.
Please do.
you had a medical exam, or rather your doctor certified that you were fit. Now, I think I'm right in saying you didn't actually have to have a medical, but you were advised to have your appendix out, or to consider having your appendix out. Now, you imagine the ethics of that. You have your appendix out. So somebody goes along and has their appendix out, and then they get a complication, and they come to grief, or they die. Now, you know, who bears the responsibility for that overall in the scheme of things? But that's with the advice, and you can see the wisdom of it. So I went along to my boss at that time, a chap called Mr. Bennett Jones, who was a lovely man, great surgeon. And I remember the conversation, and Mr. Jones, I want to go to the Antarctic. Yes, Wilkins, yes. They've advised me to have my appendix out. Oh, really? Hmm. I'm wondering, sir, whether you would do that for me. Yes. Well, OK, clerk the patients in, and when you've got them all clerked in, clerk yourself in and go up to bed on such and such a ward, and we'll do you at the end of the list. And that was how it was done. And so the appendix came out, and it was joy sore, and it was a good experience. It was a good experience because it taught me how painful it is to have an operation. And I also learned something about one of the nurses who actually I thought was a very good nurse, but she was not very good on the old pain relief, you know. Pull yourself together. I need something for the pain, sister. No, just man up. And so it was a good learning experience.
Was that common, or was it because you were a doctor that they wanted you to have your appendix out because you were kind of indispensable?
I think it was quite common. I think it was in those days, Chris. Yeah. You didn't have to, but it was advised. And you can see, you know, in those days how difficult it would have been if you'd had an appendicitis. You know, I think the access by air was, certainly for the British bases, was in its infancy and practically non-existent. So, you know, if you've got that sort of thing when you're down south, you're in trouble.
Well, I suspect the subject of appendicitis will return later in the interview, because you had to do one yourself at some point.
Yeah.
Was there much of a gap between being so told you're going south and actually sailing? And what was done in that period?
I think it was probably about 18 months.
How much is that?
Yes, I think it was something like that. And I'm a bit hazy on that, but there was a gap, and they slotted me in to fit in with, I guess, what I was doing at the time. But then, yes, I'm sure that's the way it worked, so that I could do the various things I had to and tidy up. And then I had to get a research project together as well. And I think that's the interesting, an interesting facet of that time, because you were slotted into an ongoing, not program, but there were a series of FID doctors who wanted to do physiology of some sort, and who went to work or were lodged at this wonderful place in Hampstead, up at the top of Holly Hill, called the National Institute of Medical Research. And there, in that division, which was the division of human physiology, environmental sciences, as I remember, were the most eclectic crowd of explorer scientists you could ever wish to meet. There were some real remarkable characters there. And they went off to all the places from Papua New Guinea to Borneo to Africa. And these, although I was pretty ignorant when I started there, these people were great names in their field. You know, they did terrific work. And they'd had a climate chamber which was unique in this country, where they could mimic anything from a snowstorm through to tropical heat, high humidity and all the rest of it. They had other facilities, you know, all the treadmills and research paraphernalia for exercise testing. And one of the characters there, I mean, there were several particular characters, but the one character there called Griffith Pugh, who was a ginger-haired chap, and he was getting on a bit. He was a bit ageless, but he had been the physiologist on the successful 1953 expedition to Everest. And he was pursuing his same line of work, which was establishing the aerobic capacity of people, the work, the energy consumption, oxygen consumption, all the rest of it and so forth. And it was always said about Griffith by the leaders of that expedition, Edmund Hillary and so forth, that he gave them the last 2,000 feet which enabled them to succeed on Everest, because he worked out that they needed oxygen flows at a higher rate than had been established. They needed more water and fluid and et cetera, et cetera. So it influenced how they staggered the camps and all the rest of it and so forth. So a great man, totally irascible, and interpersonal skills of probably a badly aimed brick, but focused and brilliant, you know, a great man. And myself and John Brotherhood and John Fry, we were quite keen to do young lad stuff and go off sailing with him, and he needed a crew, so we got to know him very well and had some lovely journeys and times with him on his catamaran, Pelican. So he was one character. But the point about the time there was, you arrived, and in the true British tradition, nobody was expecting you. And it was, oh, yeah, all right. And, well, go down there. I think that's where the FIDs live generally. And you go down and say, hello, my son. Oh, who are you? Yes, fine. OK, well, you can put your stuff there. And what are you going to do? And then you go off and have coffee and you chat around and you gradually get absorbed into the community. And Tom Davis was there, and he was a lovely man. He went into public health later on and was in Cambridge. And he was a very good mentor. But Murray Roberts, I got to know later on, he came back. I met him in the Antarctic. And others, John Fry and so forth. Mm. All good people. And I'd really got to sort out a research project which got me off the base, and that was a proposer, you know, because you know you couldn't just go swanning off. You had to have, and I was determined to get a degree out of it, because coming back to your earlier question, I knew that if I didn't actually have something on paper to show that I'd done something, instead of just going what we call swanning, that would be the death knell. But if I could come back and say, oh, I wanted to do this wonderful piece of physiology, which really needed to be done. I mean, Nobel Prize winning stuff, and the fact that it was at Halley Bay in the Antarctic was incidental, really. And if you could sell it rather like that, then sure, I don't think it would influence your surgical career.
What I find interesting about that period, well, that era, actually, up until quite recently, is that you were taken on, and then they said, oh, what do you fancy doing? It yes. wasn't as if there was already a list of research work yes. that needed to be done. And, oh. Sorry, Wilkins, but you're down for this one.
That's
it was
right.
very much a case of...
It was the era still of the great British amateur researchers. And those are the days when you could do what you wanted. And I think one has a great nostalgia for that. And one wonders, really, whether the current approach is as effective as possible. Now, Kevin Walton would probably argue, well, I know he would argue with it, because now that's not allowed. But it has, over the years, produced some great sort of serendipitous type of discoveries and so forth. It's a different approach. And that was the way it was done in those days. And universities weren't too fussed about funding, you know, the young researcher just for a year or two, you know, under the title of lecturer or doing a postgraduate degree, a PhD, or in medicine, an MD. And it seemed to work, because it ended up with people doing stuff that they wanted to do and pursuing their own line of what turned them on, as opposed to actually, you know, you will do that and you will do that, which I think is, to me, would have been much less stimulating.
But was there any mentoring when you came up with your plan? Did somebody then vet it and say, yes, fine?
Yeah, but this, the whole setup was presided over as a benign dictatorship by Otto Edholm, who was a great name in environmental physiology. He wrote a book called Life in a Cold Climate, which was a definitive work in its day of the physiology of cold adaptation, you know, covering anything from hibernation to how people adapt to cold and so forth. So he was the director of the laboratories and the whole of that institute. And he was your supervisor, and so you had to supervise him. But I mean, you made the appointments and mornings, and his secretary made sure that you knew when you turned up. And it was all, and he just gave you gentle guiding hands. And then when you thought you got this, he said, right, that's okay, you can do that. And you'd got your title for your thesis, and you'd mapped out the protocol. And then it was a question of getting the gear. Well, just go down and order it. And you went down to the stores and said, can I have this, this, and this? And they said, yes, fine, okay, what about that? Yes, fine. And it was a minimum of paperwork. And then gradually stuff came in, and you stacked it under the desk. But the coffee, the chief place where research is stimulated and done is the coffee room. Mm. You've got to have a coffee room where people mix, get to know each other, chat, go off and look at each other's work, stimulate, and so forth. That's the essential thing in any laboratory, I think.
You bumped into Heinz Wolff whilst you were going through this process.
Yes.
Was he an inspiration?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Terrific chap. And he's still about.
I saw him quite recently.
Yeah.
Doing a stage show.
And he hasn't changed.
No.
No, he hasn't changed. Right. He's quite a remarkable man. But I needed, in the project, I mean, again, it comes out of this business of seeing what's around, learning, educating, and then thinking, well, I can do that with that for this project. And I needed to have some method of measuring the core temperatures of people. Now, in those days, it was there are other methods now which are more reliable and all the rest of it. But in those days, that would have been quite difficult, because you had to sort of go sticking probes into unmentionable places or down unmentionable places. And he had come up with these little temperature-sensitive radio pills, they were called, endoradiosondes. And they were about the size of a big lozenge, I would say, about a couple of centimetres, 1.5 centimetres long and half a centimetre wide, and had a little tiny battery. And they sort of gave a radio signal out, which you could pick up on an aerial, and then translate that frequency, which was a beat frequency, to be technical. So you get the null point, and you could translate that into a temperature. You could calibrate the dial into a temperature. Bit of a fiddle, because they needed calibrating against a thermometer in a water bath and all this sort of thing, and they did tend to drift. But for the day, they were pretty good. And he invented the pressure-sensitive radio pill as well, which I came to use later on, quite a few years later, when I was doing some work on colons at and colonic pressures in Barts as a registrar. And he'd got people there who were doing all sorts of things. He'd got a chap called Henry Light, who was looking at measuring blood flow using the Doppler effect of ultrasound. And Henry was, I can't remember his nationality, but he was a lovely man. And, you know, people were saying, well, actually, his work was seminal. And how do people investigate vascular tree now? They do it with Doppler ultrasound. And so I guess he was one of the pioneers of that. And although one didn't know it at the time, one was in the presence of greatness. And there were others like that as well.
Was Heinz Wolff enthusiastic about the Antarctic?
Yes, I think he was. I think he was. But, I mean, he was a polymath. And he was really just interested in anything. I remember one of his great passions was pianolas, you know, these... And he put on a couple of evening sessions where he would just have his machines there and be playing these roles. And one of the great times was hearing Rachmaninoff play Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto on a roll. And it was Rachmaninoff who had recorded it, the man with the big hands. Mm. So he was a great man.
You better define then what your physiological project was, the final version that you went south armed, prepared to do.
Well, at that time, people were very interested in whether and how you adapted to cold and to heat. It wasn't understood properly. It was understood as a phenomenon, but it wasn't fully, the mechanism wasn't fully worked out, and it hadn't been, how can I put it, in the field, you know, the interaction between field conditions and heat adaptation, or I later found out cold adaptation, was still not, it was at the stage where you could do that sort of work and it would be acceptable because it added to a general bank of knowledge. But it wasn't mind-blowing pivotal research, but it sort of added to the sum of. And so the idea was that you could actually go out into a very cold environment, and if you were working hard, fully clothed, your body would have more of a problem getting rid of the heat than it would be challenged by cold. And so very quickly your core temperature would get stressed, or would stress the body by virtue of being high, and you would become adapted to heat. Now, adaptation to heat, or acclimatization to heat, as it was popularly called, is evidenced by the ability to work in the heat, but a surrogate marker is that your sweat rate goes up. You have the ability to sweat sooner, to a greater capacity, and to retain salt, so you don't actually lose a lot of salt through it. So you're more efficient at bringing heat to the surface and then getting rid of it. So if you measure a sweat rate, you've got a surrogate marker of someone's adaptation to heat acclimatization. Mm. And that was the theory. So the theory was to go off and do various scenarios, including sledging man, and to see whether, in fact, they became more adapted to heat than to cold, or certainly in the first instance, to see whether they became adapted to heat. Practical applications? Well, it did have, because if you have a bunch of soldiers who have got to fly off to different parts of the world and be effective, or any other group of people, you don't want them actually going out there and then having to adapt. I mean, if you've got people who are already adapted by virtue of something they're doing in a cold environment like the UK, by the time they go out there, they've got an edge. They're actually part acclimatised. So it sort of had an attraction and curiosity value. So I took these radio pills to measure the stress that people were getting in whatever situation, but I hope mainly sledging. And I took the radio equipment and the stuff to calibrate. And then I had to work out some way of measuring sweat rates. Mm. And what they had were these suits. And I can't remember whether they were used in Hampstead. I think they must have been. But they were made out of PVC. and you got into them. You got into them. They were totally enclosed, and they had these little tubes running up and down inside them, and it was sealed at the neck by a rubber latex ring, so a bit like a diving suit, I guess. Quite primitive, but they're made by Plysiou. So I've got a bunch of these, and then all one had to do was to heat the person up in that suit by whatever means. We used a bath of hot water in the end, and get them to a particular core temperature, keep them there for a particular time, and measure the amount of sweat that came off in that time when the core was at that level, and you had a rough and ready marker of adaptation. And that's what we did.
Did you try this out on guinea pigs before you went south?
No. Right, I mean, so I'd done some... These, now I think of it, I'm sure these suits were actually being used. And I think in that sense, yes. I think I'm almost certain, although I'm a bit hazy on the point, that I knew the system would work because that's how they did it. Yes, I'm sure that's how it happened.
Mm. And were you expecting certain results?
One hoped, yes. One hoped that one would show a trend. And that proved to be the case. It wasn't... You would predict it. You've got young men sledging, which involves actually working hard, very high calorie intakes if you're ski-during alongside a sledge for a few days. For many hours a day for a week or two. You actually burn up about 5,000 kilocalories, and that's hard work. That's equivalent to heavy manual labouring. Mm. And of course you become adapted to heat, work in the heat. So it was really expected, and it showed that, and it was quite clear. And there wasn't, I don't think, any instance I'm right in saying where it showed a perverse trend. But the interesting question then arose, could you actually induce cold adaptation as well as heat adaptation? And that was a much more, I thought that was a really interesting question. And that sort of arose while I was down there. Sort of sitting around the table with the chaps who, and one of the great things about the bases is that everybody becomes an expert on everybody else's work because you discuss it. And you'll have the diesel mechs advising the astrophysicist about the next step he should be taking to do this, that and the other. And everybody's got an opinion and a view. And I have to say, sometimes they're pretty to the point.
So were you able to actually do part two of your project? Were you able to assess what happens to people in cold conditions?
Yes, so it became apparent. We did the sledging bit, and I think that went well, and it was good fun. Everybody enjoyed it, and especially they enjoyed the bath, you know, because baths were in short supply on the base, so they enjoyed the bath experiment where they actually had to...
This was a perk, was it?
Well, I think it was seen as a perk. And one drew off the sweat and measured it, and then one bottled a certain sample amount to take back to the UK to see whether there was something in the sodium content and that. And taking the lid off those bottles 18 months after they'd been stored was something else.
That smell.
Oh, something else. Talk about aromatic amines.
The smell got worse in the interim?
Well, I don't know. Pigs were pretty smelly characters because we weren't, you know, we only had a shower once a week.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, but it was amusing. So that had been done, and come the winter, and there's no sledging, and one's, you know, from my point of view, there's, once you've done the stores and you've looked after public health, and then you pitch in with other people's, you know, labouring and that sort of thing, you've got time to do other things. And I thought it would be interesting, and the chaps seemed to agree, to see whether we could get that acclimatisation. I think I'd read a paper somewhere by a chap called Graham Budd, who had outlined in the Antarctic some findings on people who had become acclimatised to cold. And the evidence was that you maintain your core temperature more efficiently. I think we're better at acclimatisation to heat than we probably are to to cold adaptation, but nonetheless it's a definite effect. So exposing people to a given temperature stress for a given length of time over a period, you will see an improved ability.
You'll build up a resistance to it.
Yeah, I mean, you do it in several ways. You definitely preserve your core temperature by shutting down the periphery more efficiently, but you also produce more energy. Your glycolysis and all the rest of it and so forth burns up a bit more energy. So there's those sorts of mechanisms as well, I know. But so we kicked it around the table and then eventually decided to do it. But what it involved was really stressing people quite hard to cold. And, to sit still, I thought sitting still for 2 or 3 hours or as long as you could bear it in a very cold environment, still cold environment, would be the way to go. But how to get volunteers? How to get volunteers? Now, FIDs are great. They're very hard men. They're very hard men. So I outlined the experiment and I said it would be really good and would probably win a Nobel Prize. but of course it was much, much more than human flesh and blood could stand, to sit in shirt sleeves with ear and foot and hand protection for, but essentially in shirt sleeves in a cold environment for several hours. I said that was just too much to ask of anybody and, more than flesh and blood could stand. And so it would have to go undone, this experiment. Or, don't worry, Doc, I can do that. That's more problem. And the only slight drawback, was that when we got it all sorted out and the volunteers, bless them, they said, one thing, Doc, you're doing it as well, if we do, which was a bit of a facer. So the four of us did that. It was good. And we sat there for 2 weeks, doing 3 hours a day.
Sat where?
In the Armco, the fuel store. It was a big bladder of fuel for emergency. No, it wasn't. No, it was where the fuel was stored proper. The air was still constant temperature, about minus 20. And you could sit there and do it. And it was really interesting. Over the 2 weeks, we did the exposures and we did the measurements on three separate sessions. So we did day one, then end of 7 days, end of 14 days. And you could see the exposure to cold first off, the temperature would rise, the core temperature would go up as the shell shut down and shunted the blood to the middle. This was after a period of stabilization. And then gradually it would drift down. And by the end of 2 hours, you were pretty well down. I mean, after the first hour, you were down to baseline again, to 37.5. And then below that, it drifted down. And you went down to 35.5, 36, by the end of a couple of hours.
36 centigrade.
Yeah. And you're feeling pretty miserable, feeling pretty cold, shivering and the rest of it and so forth. That was on the first exposure. By the end of the 2 weeks, you'd just gone down to baseline by the end of 2 hours. So there was a very clear, well-defined effect. I have to say that it was a bit cavalier, really, because I didn't really, if I'm honest, be careful here, know what I was doing. And it wouldn't certainly be tolerated these days, and quite rightly so. But you then, but I was aware of the slight dangers, if you like, of going out from a cold environment with hypothermia, because I'd done a lot of sailing and all that sort of stuff, into a warm environment. The shell hits the warm air, opens up, warmth, but actually can't get a lot of warmth in from the environment. The specific heat is not great. And so essentially you're perfusing a cold shell with cold core blood and the temperature just plummets. And you felt very odd if that happened. And, a couple of times consciousness was on the margins. Well, of course, if you do it sufficiently to a sufficient degree, then you will induce fibrillation of the heart, and so it could be very dangerous. But nothing happened, nothing serious, and it was fine. And that was only in the first few days while you were adapting. After that, you know, you just warmed up and didn't think anything of it. But the first stage is when you were seriously hypothermic. Warming up like that was not a very wise thing to do. So,
Was there any kind of panic signal that one of your guinea pigs could make to let you know that he'd had enough?
No, we just sort of agreed. We were all sitting there talking, and, you know, if we wanted to do something, there were the hands on her knees, and we just had to sit still. That was the only thing. And
was your sanity ever questioned?
No. I think it was questioned from the word go, actually, Chris. But no, and they all, and with the results were shared. It was a terrific community, and we all looked at it. And a lot of scientists there, you see.
Mm.
And it was that sort of ethos, inquiring ethos. And it was sort of, and people found it interesting. I mean, it was interesting. And that actually was the best work, because that then got published in the Polar Record and was still quoted. I was in correspondence with Graham Budd, who was a serious scientist, some years afterwards. And and recently John Brotherhood mentioned it at a conference we had on polar on the Scott, to do with the Scott celebrations, and he was doing physiology and he mentioned it as well. So it's interesting, you see, it's this business of serendipity, and you do one bit of work and it leads to a much more interesting question, which, if you can then go and pursue that, will often yield the greater interest or discovery, if you like.
And from the point of view of the guinea pigs, I mean, because you were getting the reaction started to vary after 2 or 3 weeks, they could actually see themselves.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I guess that kind of engendered their interest.
Yeah,
they could see changes in their own.
Yes.
Inner workings.
Ideal. Yeah. Collaborative.
Where do the Hounswolf's radio pills come in?
Well, we used them to measure the temperature, and there were various experiments I did on base. I mean, lesser things, just to get baselines and that sort of thing. And therein lay a bit of a problem one time, because I only had 4 of these things. They were precious. And Norris Riley, I remember, lovely guy, he was Geordie, as I recall. Norris came to me one morning and said, you know, I've got a radio pill, Doc. I said, yes, Norris. He said, well, you know, we're supposed to use the bucket to retrieve the radio pill, because he wrapped it in a little rubber stall, a finger stall, tied it up like that, and then he went through the poo and cleaned it off, slipped the rubber stall, and out popped the pill reasonably clean, cleaned it off, put it in another one, and reused it, you see. Doesn't sound very savoury, but it's the sort of thing that fids do all the time. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine?
I trust they were named, these pills.
No, they were spread around. They were spread around. He came to me, and I remember it, and I was sitting in the surgery or something, doing something, and he said, Doc, I've just been to the pit, which is the bog, which had been used by 25 to 30 people, I don't know, for 2 years, and started off 45 feet deep and was now of the order of about sort of 15 or 20, I guess, so you can imagine it was well used. And so I said to Norris, I said, well, that's very unfortunate. I really, really must get this pill back. I'll go and get the ladder for you, the rope ladder, which is suspended from a hook in the ceiling over the pit. And he seemed to take the attitude that it was my radio pill, and if I wanted it, I would jolly well go and get it, which I thought was a bit unchristian. And I did go down and look for it. Never found it.
Oh, really?
Never found it. It had got so cold, the signal had gone, and I think things froze pretty quick down there, and I couldn't find it.
But you came face-to-face with the infamous turdicle.
Oh, yes, went through the turdicle. And
so you were literally down this shaft?
Yeah.
Picking your way through?
Through feces. Hors d'oeuvre.
Okay.
Hors d'oeuvre. And that was a bit of a moment, and I won't say I was shunned for a while, but certainly had to do the washing.
There's a note here to ask you about the difference between wooden and plastic seats.
No, I don't think I ever sort of talked about that much. Okay. That doesn't ring a bell.
Okay.
You could probably tell me more about that. Is that something that's figured
this
in
this is
other...
from Terry Allen to ask you about the retrieval process and your observations on the heights of turdicles in the two adjacent shafts.
Oh, yes.
Perhaps one had a wooden seat and the other had a plastic seat. Is that the case?
Well, I'd have to think about that. But I do know that the turdicle was a definite phenomenon, and it was your job if you finally actually could not do your business because of the state of the turdicle, you had to go and chop it down. So that was a very fair way of sorting it out.
We've leapt about a bit, so let's go back a little bit to that period before you sailed south. And I was asking you what you did in that 18-month period. And there are two options here. One was you learned more about medicine, and perhaps you learned
yes,
a bit
I
about...
Yes, surgery, yeah.
Yeah, surgery. So how do you bone up on the surgery between being appointed and being shipped off?
Well, you're doing these posts, senior house officer posts. And I was at a lovely hospital called the Royal Southern Hospital. There were three teaching hospitals in Liverpool, and the Southern was one of them, the Northern and the Royal Infirmary. So I stayed on to, after doing my pre-registration jobs, to do my senior house officer jobs, and I did them in orthopaedics and in surgery. And you build up your experience. Now, as a senior house officer, you don't actually do much. You hold retractors at operations and that sort of thing. And the chief thing about that time is that you're a pair of hands. You're watching and learning. You will do minor surgery, so you will learn to do a bit more practical stuff, but you won't be let loose on anything serious. And certainly, it was a fairly quiet hospital. I didn't get to do an appendectomy during that time, although one watched the registrars. And you were very dependent on the registrar you were working for, the senior registrar. If they wanted the experience, you would stand there and help. And if you were lucky, you got a very experienced person, they would say, oh, well, you do this, or you do that hernia, or something like that. So the object of the jobs was to give you experience, but also you were expected to do the theory in your spare time. And by golly, you worked hard. Just hit the books all day, or all night, and every night.